So welcome everyone. Boker Tov. Good morning for our next JCC class, Purim, class number 2, Hiding in Plain Sight. So we are now going to explore a very strange Book of Esther sequence of events that very often goes unnoticed. I, until I heard this class years ago, was not one who microanalyzed the events, and it's something that you're going to see in the words. So let us start our little exploration with source number 1. So this is directly from the Book of Esther, chapter 9, verse number 1, the first pasuk. Okay? So you'll recognize the narrative. This is directly in English from the book. And in the 12th month, which is the Jewish month of Adar, on the 13th day thereof, when the king Achashverosh's order and his edict to destroy and genocide the Jews drew near to be put into execution, on the day that the Jews' enemies looked forward to ruling over them, then ahapachu, it was reversed, that the Jews should rule over their enemies. The Jews assembled in their cities, in all the provinces of King Achashverosh, 127 provinces and countries, to lay hand upon those, the Amalek, Haman guys, who sought to harm them. And no one stood up before them, for their fear had fallen upon all the people, because they had official legitimacy from the king himself. And all the princes of the provinces, and the satraps, that's a word you don't hear every day, good luck, a satrap, I think it's Persian for something, right? And the satraps, and the governors, and those that conduct the king's affairs, elevated the Jews. Why? For the fear of Mordechai, the head rabbi, fell upon them. For Mordechai was great in the king's house. Remember, he had been elevated to Haman's position, because Haman is already dead. And Mordechai's fame went forth throughout all the provinces, for the man Mordechai waxed greater and greater. Just stop for 1 second, just to give you a little context. So Esther barges in. Then they have the two parties that Haman, the king, and the queen are at. And then at the second party, she makes the big reveal. Who's this evil man trying to harm you, my queen? And she points right at Haman. And then they take Haman out and they hang him. But the problem was that even though Haman's dead, that was Passover time. It was the 16th day of the Jewish month of Nisan, second day of Passover. It's hard to see this in the text. So the letter that had been authorized by the stamp of the signet ring of King Ahasuerus, it was already dispatched. You can't take it back. The king even says, I'm sorry, an official communique can't be brought back. Sorry, there's no redo. So that letter was 11 months in the future. The annihilation of the Jews was still going to happen. So what did they do? They can't revoke the letter, but they can explain and interpret what the king's original intent was. He left it open-ended. On this day of Adar number 13, whatever the Persian day was on the calendar, right? Be ready. It didn't say to kill the Jews. It said be prepared, like for conflict. So the second letter that was authorized by Esther and Mordechai said, oh, by the way, you know, when the king sent out that first letter to be ready to take vengeance, it's not against anybody other than Haman's followers. Oh, so all Haman's followers slunk away because they were about to be wiped out, and that was the war. And the 10 sons of Haman apparently were involved because they were intimately involved in the process of their dad. They were not little children. They were adults who helped build the gallows and did a whole bunch of nefarious things. So Haman is already dead, okay? But his death alone does not stop the process that he put into play. Okay? That's very important to know. Look at source number 1, second paragraph, please. We're continuing on. So what happened when the Jewish people turned around against Haman's followers 11 months after Haman's demise? And the Jews smote all their enemies with the stroke of the sword and with slain and destruction. And they did to their enemies, means Haman's followers, as they wished. And in Shushan HaBirah, and in Shushan the capital city, the Jews slew and destroyed 500 men, because these were 500 followers of Haman. And Parshan, Datta, Dalfon, Apasa, and it lists 10 guys. Who are these 10 guys? They're the 10 sons of Haman. the son of Hammedata. Sorer HaYehudim, the adversary of the Jews. They slew, but on the spoil, meaning the spoils of Haman's family, because they're a Amalek, you're not allowed to take their spoils, even though, remember we learned last week that King Saul allowed the sheep and the animals to be taken as spoils. They did not do that. They did not take any of their money. Okay, so stop right now. So what happens? So the immediate war takes place in Shushan, because that's where the action's happening. That's where the capital city is. That's where Haman used to live before he was hanged. And that's where the royal palace is, and Esther and Mordecai. Everyone's in the capital city. So the war starts there, and then the war spreads throughout all the 127 provinces. So the king doesn't know, because it's real time. There's no Gaza Health Ministry to bring very fake numbers back. I'm joking, because you know they just made numbers up. They discovered last week or something that like some huge percentage of all the numbers that they were supposedly killed were Hamas fighters. But of course, it's never reported in real time. So the king just hears the reports of the 500 who died. And it bothers him because, you know, holy smokes, I gave you permission, Mordecai and Esther, to like rise up against Haman's followers. But I didn't think there were that many Nazi, anti-Semitic, you know, guys hanging around. So the king is unprepared for the reality of the war. So he's a little dismayed. So he's very angry. And look at the continuation of source one. On that day, so we're now talking, I know exactly the date. It's the 13th day of Adar, the day of that would eventually become the fast of Esther, the day before Purim, okay? So on that day, the number of those slain in Shushan, the capital, came before the king. Stop. So the king gets the list that 500 were killed. He's not happy. You can hear him. And the king said to Queen Esther, you can hear his voice, in Shushan, the capital, the Jews slew and destroyed 500 men, and the 10 sons of Haman, meaning they're dead also. In the rest of the king's provinces, what have they done? And then he just, in a moment, switches from clear anger or astonishment at the minimum. And now he like, something happens. We don't know. I have an observation to make. And look at the next verse. Now, what is your petition? And it shall be granted you. And what is your request? And it shall be done. So what happened? So I surmise that Esther did her Esther number. Okay, Esther has the king. Okay, she's so beautiful. She just has him. So he is irate. 500 died, right? And so you can hear his voice, his pompous idiot. And then she just flutters her beautiful eyes. And he's like, oh, you're right, my dear. Anybody else here? Do you want more bullets, more guns? What do the Jews need to fight the Hamas guys? You know what I mean? Like it's do you see that? In an instant, he switches to like, what else could, you know, what else would you like? I haven't given you enough armaments for the Israelis to fight. Here, just name it. You know, he takes his checkbook out. What do you need? What's your request? It's amazing, right? That little moment. I'm just putting that as an aside. Okay. So what does Esther ask for? Hold on to your questions, but it's mind-bending, okay? Listen to what she asks. And Esther said, remember, you can have anything you want. You're Queen Esther. Look what she asks for. If it pleases the king, let tomorrow too be granted to the Jews to do as today's decree. Let's continue fighting for one more day. And let them hang Haman's 10 sons on the gallows. Now the king ordered that it be done so. So shall be done. And a decree was given in Shushan, and they hanged Haman's 10 sons. What is going on? You already told us, like, literally 4 verses earlier, what happened to Haman's sons. They're already dead. Okay, so I have a very easy approach. You ready? This is like the Wild West. Yeah? So Haman's sons do not die by hanging. They died in the battle, probably by sword. Okay, because we told us there were swords and there was lots of chivalry going on. Haman's 10 sons fought. They lost. They were killed. So what was Esther asking for? This is the simple, my approach. She says, take their dead bodies, bring them into the town square where the gallows already exists. Because remember, Haman ordered his sons, and they constructed this huge gallows, like amazing size. And they took the 10 sons, and they hanged them, they're dead already, as a display. one over the other, all the way down. Boom, 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 boom. Basically, as a shout out to the latent Haman lovers who are like lurking around in the shadows, but who are not fighting, but they kind of support the Haman cause. But she wants to sort of ward off the evil by saying, hey, don't mess with the Jews. This is what happens to you. So in other words, she's very simply saying, take their bodies that were killed already in the battle that happened, and just simply hang them up. Like, right, in the old days, they would take, I hate to say this, they would take the head of a guy and put it on a stake, you know, and they would say, don't mess with the king. You don't mess with the Jews. You don't mess with King Ahasuerus and his wife Esther, the Jewish queen. I think that's the easiest explanation. That makes sense. However, Rav Yaakov Moshe, have you heard this whole thing yet? Have you been here for part of this? Have you heard this before? You have. Okay. So, you don't mind hearing it again? Okay. Will you tell the audience here that they need to hold on to their hats? Hold on to your hats, yeah, please. Okay. So, let us now offer an alternative approach from Rabbi Noach Weinberg of blessed memory from Eshet Torah. Now, you've heard a lot about Torah codes, I'm sure. In fact, one of the head rabbis who came up with many of these codes, I had brought him here years ago. His name is Professor Gans, G-A-N-S, lives in Baltimore. Brilliant man. However, this is the best of the best. In my humble opinion, when I first heard this, I had like, I was fluttering, you know, my mind, and I was just blown away. I hope that you will have the same response. So please turn to the back page. So on the back page, you already had this translated. You have, and I literally created it in source at the top of the page, the way it's written in the book of Esther. So you may remember that we have a custom to say the names of the 10 sons of Haman. If we're able to, the one reading the Megillah tries to say it in one breath. And then they turn blue and keel over. No, but it's a tradition because they were all hanged like one individual, meaning they all were a Amalek. They were all this one entity, and therefore in one breath, we try to just mention them all, right? So the guy reading it will go like this. And that's why, by the way, this is a state secret. That's why we have groggers. Because otherwise the poor Megillah reader would just collapse. So we need to make lots of noise at that moment just to give a respite to the poor Book of Esther reader that they don't keel over and remain keeled over and we have to call the paramedics. Okay, but do you notice stylistically it's very odd. Now every Megillah, every Book of Esther that we have ever seen going back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years stylistically have the same layout. So you notice that on the right column are the names of the 10 sons of Haman. Boo-is. But on the left, it's basically the eight, and. But our Mesorah, our rabbinic tradition, when we write a Megillah, you have to write it with that style where you leave this huge empty space, name on the right, and. So it's a lot of things are weird. First of all, why would we write it this way? Now I'm going to bring some questions up. Look at the left-hand column. There's a letter Vav, then there's a letter Aleph, and there's a letter Tav. So if you have Ve'et, it means and you're pointing to something. The word et or et in Hebrew, it's pointing to something else. So if my intention is just to say, here are the 10 sons of Haman. Parshandata, Dalfon, Aspata, Porat, right? You don't need et. You only need one little lonely letter called a vav. It's called the vav hachibur, the connecting letter vav. And Joe, and Bill, and Bob, and David, and Mike, right? That's all you need. So why is there an eight? The only reason there's an eight is it's directing you to someone else. But the someone else is not written in the book of Esther. It's absent. Wow. So it's almost like it's listing 10 sons and 10 other people? Well, that's, yeah, it's weird, right? The name is missing. We don't know. Maybe were there 10 sons of Haman that we don't know, that we forgot their names? Were there really? It's weird. I have an approach, okay? So file that away. Do you also notice that embedded in the first name of his son, Parshandata, there's a tiny letter Tov, the second last letter is small. That's not a typo, that's deliberate. And then fire all the way down to the sixth name, Parmashta. There's a tiny little letter Shin. And then the last name, Vayizata. A huge Vav, double size, and another tiny Zion. Okay? So there's something called Gematria, Jewish numerology. Mm-hmm. Each letter, we use them like, for example, when we write a monument for somebody who passed away. And you want to have the year, so you write Tov Shin, which is 700. So each of these letters has 400, 300. Aleph is 1, Bet and Vet is 2, Yud is 10, Kaf and Chaf and Chaf Sefit would be 20. So we have a numerology in Judaism, and we use that for dates and for, that's just how we write it, okay? So that's called Gematria. And the source of Gematria is God, because the language is a very connective, mystical language. So those three tiny letters and that one giant letter don't belong. What's with that? So I'm going to offer you something, I believe, amazing. But look at the Gematria. I did it for you at the bottom. The tiny letter Tav is 400 in the Gematria. Yeah? You see it? I listed down below. Shin, or Sin, is 300. Zion is 7. So that's 707, like the Boeing 707. Yeah? And then the question is, if it adds up to perhaps a year, Tav, Shin, Zion, the year 707. But here's the problem. How do I know what millennia it is? So the year 707 by itself takes you back to the time of like Adam and Noah. Because remember, the Jewish people got out of Egypt in the year 2448. So this is like 1700 years before the Jewish people got out of the Exodus. So we're going back to the beginning of Genesis. So could it be that this is somehow an allusion to the year, the original year 707? Or is it 1707 in the Jewish calendar? We're right now, just for a sense of connection, we're in the year 5786. We're in 5786. So what, is there a number that, is there like a millennia number, the thousand, the millennia that goes ahead of that? Well, what is that huge Vav doing? It's, remember, it's oversized. So the little letters in this approach are the year. But how do we contextualize the year itself? The big Bob would be 6,000. What number then goes ahead of 707? If we're leading up to the sixth millennia, it would be a 5. Because remember, the clock, when we get to 6,000, all of a sudden it's a seventh millennium. Mm. So if you go by that large Vav in the last name of the 10th son of Haman, that large Vav, Vayezaso, that large Vav, do you see how I put it at the bottom of your sheet? I put a 5 in parentheses. So that corresponds to the Jewish year 5,707, because there is no way to write 5,707. Like, there's no letter that goes before the Tav Shin Zion. When you see a monument, like I do monuments when people pass away, you just write Tav Shin Pei Hey, if somebody passed away in 5786. There's no way to get the 5 on a monument. We just don't have it. However, that millennia...
I'm missing something.
Okay. The millennia has to define what date in history this could be referring to. So how do we know what the millennia is? That letter Vav equals the number 6, correct? But why is it large? Because it's the millennia context. The other three letters add up, Tav Shin Zion, to 707, yeah? But what number, if any, goes before the 707? It could be nothing, or it could be 1707, 27. Does everyone following me? So I'm saying that large Vav, according to Rabbi Weinberg in Eshet Torah, that large Vav means we put a 5 in front of the 707. Because the Vav is the millennia where 707 is going to happen. So what year is that? 5,707. What year is that in the Gregorian?
79 years ago.
1946. 1946. So embedded, the end of World War II and the Holocaust, embedded in this Torah code in the Megillah are the three little letters, 707. Remember we said we added them up right there at the bottom of that page. So you have the number 707 and that large oversized letter. By the way, when you go to synagogue or temple, or whatever, ask to see the real Megillah that you guys read from. You will see that what I did not make, I promise you 100%, every book of Esther ever written has these three letters, tiny and the big Vav. So I'm not making this up, okay? Only we now are going to have, as Paul Harvey would say, the rest of the story, okay? Something is connected to the 10 sons of Haman that happened in the year 5707. And remember, we're looking for, remember the curiosity? Why did it say across from each name, along with such and such a, they're not there. Well, what if I tell you that in the year 5707, 1946, we added 10 Amalek Haman people to that list. So in 1946, after World War II, there was the very famous Nuremberg War Crimes Trial. In fact, they just made a movie. I did not see it because I hear the movie was 4.5 hours long. I'm joking. But apparently Russell Crowe played Hermann Göring, Yimach Shemo, and he apparently was incredible, Russell Crowe, as Hermann Göring was the third most powerful member of the Nazi hierarchy, right? Hitler was at the top. Himmler was second. They both took their own lives, maybe. I'm joking. And then that we don't know for sure. Himmler they caught and he poisoned himself. And then the third guy on that chain who would have been the most powerful man in Nazi Germany was the head of the Luftwaffe. And his name was Hermann Göring. They put the 11 biggest Nazis that they could find, the Brits and the Americans, and if there were any French still fighting, I don't know. By the end of World War II, they had a war crimes trial when they realized the enormity of what the Germans had perpetrated against the Jews. They decided to have a very public, and it was a military tribunal. It took place, of course, in Nuremberg in 1946. They made a phenomenal movie of Maximilian Schell, who won the Academy Award, Judgment at Nuremberg. Remember, a very famous Academy Award mini movie. Was, I think Spencer Tracy might have been in it. It's a very famous movie. And like I said, you can see movies and books. I happened to read one Tisha B'Av. I didn't read the whole thing. I kind of leafed through it. Called The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. You understand if you've seen the book, you can't read it in one day. It's I don't know, it's over 1,000 pages. So one night the B'Av, I felt it was okay to read that book because it's all about the decimation of our people. So all this information that I have is coming from real sources. And you can look it up after the class, okay? So they had a trial. And the trial took a long time, months and months and months. And the Germans, the Nazis were given a defense. But, of course, what defense did they have? Some of them tried to claim, you know, I'm just following orders, which was Adolf Eichmann, Yimach Shemo. That was his defense when Israel brought him back in the early 1960s for trial in Israel. Adolf Eichmann, who was the arch executor of this, but he had escaped, remember? We never got him. He managed to get to South America, was living in plain sight, right, as a little nothing in Argentina. My parents, of blessed memory, went to one of the days of his trial. They were Jewish journalists. They were able, and they, my parents remember them bringing him out. He was in a glass booth to protect him because they were worried people would take a shot at him. And I asked my mom and dad, I said, I want to know, what is the consummate evil look like? And they said, doesn't look like anything. He's nondescript. Looks like a bookkeeper. He has like little, nothing. So evil does not have to look, I mean, you saw Adolf Hitler or Himmler, they dress the part. They kind of look warped. Whereas this guy just was like nothing, you know? So he's the only one, by the way, in the history of Israel to be officially executed by the state. Okay? So that's Adolf Eichmann. So they never caught Adolf Eichmann, you know, and Mengele, all these other horrific people, Martin Berman, they escaped and they were either captured later or they were killed. They died of their own, unfortunately, right? Okay, but these 11 were tried, found guilty of crimes against humanity, and they were sentenced to death. So it's a military tribunal. And I don't know the history here, but you can look it up maybe after. But it was decided, and I don't know why, to change the protocols of the mode of execution. Normally, it's a firing squad. Because a military person, you get up against a wall, you count to three, and then you're dead, right? The guys shoot you. They decided not. Do you want to guess what they decided to do as the mode of execution? Hanging. Wow. Hanging. Okay, but there were 11. Yeah? There's 11. Not 10 missing. There's only 11 Nazis who are going to be killed. By the way, the date of their death, when this happened, the execution, was Hoshana Rabbah, 1946. Hoshana Rabbah is the end of judgment from Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. It's the last day of God's judgment in the world. And that's the day this takes place. The night before the 11 are going to face their maker, someone somehow slips a cyanide pill into Hermann Göring's cell, and he takes his own life. There were 11, and now they're only
cowards.
10. Now they're only 10.
Oh my.
Now what's bizarre is that there were 11 children of Haman. He had a daughter, but the daughter tried to pour the urinal pot on the head of the person who was leading the horse that she thought her father would be on the horse, Haman, who specifically said to the king, if you want to honor this guy, lead this guy around on a horse. And she thought, well, Rabbi Mordechai is going to be the guy in front. And as she's dumping the chamber pot from above, from an apartment above, her dad looks up and kaboom. That's why the Megillah says he's bezoy bekatzef. He has like his disgraced. As the, you know how bad things happen in real life? So as in slow motion, the chamber pot's coming down to hit dear old dad, Haman. The daughter is mortified because she looks up and makes eye contact with dad. She throws herself off the building and kills herself. Hermann Göring used to wear women's clothes. I'm not making this up. This is absolute fact. He's like J. Edgar Hoover. I don't know what it means, but so he took cyanide. He took his own life. There were 11 sons and daughters of Haman, and then one of them committed suicide, so only 10 were hanged. There were 11 Nazis tried and found guilty, but only 10 were hanged. Wow. Okay. This is now. Hold on to your hats, please, okay? So the 10 are brought for execution. And we have their actual last words, because they were given an opportunity to say whatever they wanted to say before they went downstairs where the fun stops and meets Hashem in a very bad way, yeah? The 10th one to die, the last one, was the most despicable, monstrous, even though he didn't kill one Jew. You've probably heard of him. He was the propaganda head, not Joseph Goebbels, Yimach Shmo, but the original friend of Hitler from the 1920s. His name was Julius Streicher. You'll look him up. He was the worst of the worst. He was in charge of Der Stürmer, which propagandized and made it possible for the Holocaust to happen by demonizing and stripping away the humanity from the Jews. Der Stürmer, you'll look him up. In fact, I'm going to read you an account from Time magazine, okay, that I printed out to myself. Okay? Julius Streicher, 12th of February, 1885 to the 16th of October, 1946, that's the day of Hoshana Rabbah where he is killed, was a prominent Nazi prior to World War II. He was the founder and publisher of Der Stürmer newspaper, which became a central element of the Nazi propaganda machine. Streicher was hanged in the early hours of October 16, 1946, along with the 9 other condemned defendants from the first Nuremberg trial. And then it says in parentheses, Hermann Göring, Streicher's nemesis, committed suicide only hours earlier. That's why he's explaining why there were 11 and now there are 10. Streicher was the most melodramatic of the hangings that were carried out that night. At the bottom of the scaffold, he cried out, Heil, you know what? And then he says something like, the Bolsheviks are going to hang you one day like you are hanging me. When he mounted the platform, hold on, Streicher delivered his last words. Purim Fest, 1946.
What?
Purim Fest, 1946 were the last words of Julius Streicher. And then Time magazine has to then quote, by the way, if you don't know what Purim is, it's a very insignificant holiday to the non-Jewish world. The Jewish holiday of Purim celebrates the escape by the Jews from extermination at the hands of Haman, an ancient Persian government official. At the end of the Purim story, Haman is hanged. The last words of this Haman are Happy Purim, 1946. And then he's hanged. By the way, Esther, when she's having this mysterious conversation, asks the king for permission. She says, let him be hanged on the tree, on the gallows. The British executioner who killed the 10, his name was Woods. I'm not making this up, okay? Okay, now we're going to go back and read the conversation because I saved a little tidbit for the end. You ready? Can you go back to your conversation? Source 1, the third paragraph, please. Okay? Before we read it together with a new prism of understanding, there is a tradition in the Talmud and Megillah. The Talmud says, where is God in the Megillah? And that's a question. God's name does not overtly appear, not once, in the book of Esther, because he hid his countenance. So the rabbis of the book of Esther say, well, he is there, kind of. Whenever there is any mention of a melech, a king, without first identifying the king contextually as King Ahasuerus, whenever that would happen in the book, it happens a couple times, that is not a reference to the king of flesh and blood, Ahasuerus. It's a direct reference to God, the King of Kings. Yeah? So there is no reference to Ahasuerus in this entire little saga. Okay, ready? Doesn't say it in the first part, but in that, on that day, which begins a new little segment, on that day, there's no mention of who's talking. So let's now switch from Ahasuerus talking to Esther, because we wondered the turnaround, like the weird languages didn't make sense. I tried to, maybe she fluttered her eyebrow, you know, but we didn't really know. Now pretend she's talking to God. She's petitioning God. Okay, ready? On that day, the number of those slain in Shushan the capital came before God. And God said to King Esther, in response obviously to her prayer, in Shushan the capital, the Jews slew and destroyed 500 men and the 10 sons of Haman. In the rest of the king, meaning Ahasuerus, lowercase king's provinces, what have they done? You don't know, Esther, but it's obviously a lot. Okay, so now it makes sense. What is your petition and shall be granted to you, Esther? What else do you want from me? I, God, have done a lot. What does Esther say? If it pleases you, Hashem, the king, let Machar tomorrow too be granted to the Jews to do as today's decree, and let them hang Haman's 10 sons on the gallows. Now Hashem ordered that it be done so, and a decree was given in Shushan, and they hanged Haman's 10 sons. Okay. The word for tomorrow in Hebrew is Machar. Mem Chet Resh, tomorrow. So the Gemara, once again in Talmud, says in another place that there is a tomorrow which is literally tomorrow, and then there's a tomorrow which is in vernacular the future. So this word tomorrow is not tomorrow like as in the 14th day of the Jewish month of Adar. It's tomorrow as in some future date. Now Esther is asking God to help us. She's aware that this is an eternal battle with Haman and his followers. It doesn't end with Haman's death. It will not end today or tomorrow, literally, because it's every generation's going to face October 7th. We faced a Haman of our generation. It's going to go. And she's asking God, please, in the worst moment where Haman's followers are ascended, can you stop it? Hang them. Hang the 10 sons. Oh, and I'm going to come on to a thought that you probably have in your mind in a minute. I'll end with that, okay? So what is she asking for? She's asking that the Nazis be hanged. She doesn't know that they're Nazis. How could she? She doesn't know what the future is going to be. But she says, God, there's a place in the Megillah for 10 more Haman guys. Please don't let my children, my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren suffer again and be annihilated. Please hang them. Okay. So before I get to one last little comment, it's mind-bending. I'm sure your mind is bent right now. Okay? The reality is that Esther, and people criticize this approach. They say, wait a minute, Rabbi, he didn't really do it because it happened after. Esther wasn't asking for this to happen in 1946. She didn't have a date in mind. How could she? She's just saying, God, stop the Holocaust, or whatever that could be. She doesn't know what it is. God obviously had his reasons to have a Holocaust. We don't know what they are. He granted the petition of Esther after the fact, after 6 million are dead. So that's an open question that we have to ask God. We don't know. In other words, the prayer was effective. It had to be responded to. We now understand 100% the 10 sons of Haman, the 10 Nazis. We understand it, but we don't know the big question, which you're probably thinking about, but it was futile. Like, because it didn't happen in 1935. It didn't happen in 1939. Why did it have to wait to 1946? And I don't have an answer for you. But maybe, as a thought, in the same way that there's a mystery in our world, we don't really understand until after the game is played, like what the components are. And we can't possibly understand 1.2 million little Jewish children. I mean, there's no rhyme or reason. It's beyond our human purview, yeah? But maybe for thousands of years now, nobody could interpret and understand these mysterious little letters and the big letter and the open space and what that meant. Remember, no generation until Rabbi Weinberg comes around could have had access to this information. Number one, it didn't happen until 1946. So before that, nobody could have made sense. In other words, everyone scratched their heads. Well, why are we have the 10 sons of Haman? You know, I don't know, right? The rabbis couldn't give a class on this because it didn't happen yet. But maybe it's a little bit of a shout out to us. It's my theory. In the same way that God doesn't appear directly in the book, and God is mysterious to us, we don't know. We can't know. But there are things that are embraces and kisses that God embeds. So maybe for the children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren of Holocaust victims and survivors, having this and contextualizing the idea that what happened is not in a vacuum. What happened is a continuing story of what happened in the Bible when we left Egypt, that continued in the time of Saul, it continued in Persia, in the time of Ahasuerus, Mordecai, and Esther, and it continues today. Maybe there's some solace in knowing that, yeah, we'll get answers one day. We're going to ask God, hey, how come these things happen, right? It's the most mysterious question. Why do bad things happen to good people? We don't know. We can't possibly know. But having this laid out shows us that God is there. He's hidden, but he's there. And perhaps us having access to it now and seeing it even in retrospect, and maybe you can question the efficacy of what happened, and maybe the timeliness wasn't what we, and Esther obviously prayed for a proactive approach, not a reactive approach to this. I mean, how could she know? She didn't. She just asked. She davened. We should daven. We should be like Esther. We should use this Purim to pour our hearts out and hope that this time it will be a proactive approach. And when God answers our tefillot as the children, whether literally or just spiritually, of Esther, of Mordecai, the heroes, the heroine, we should just know that God is there and God listens to our prayers. And this time let us pray that when we pray for salvation for our people, for Israel, for American Jewry, for world Jewry, that God will have a proactive approach. Thank you, everyone.